your contribution to this station right now. Just call 713-526-5738 or give online at
90.1 KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
On KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community media, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Now, I know that I can be a nag about this, but we really are less than a week away from the last day to register, which is October 11th. So if you haven't registered, you must get it to the county clerk by the 11th, by the end of business the 11th.
And that is registering to vote, just to be absolutely clear.
Yes, registering to vote, not like with a draft or something.
Yeah.
Also, if you think you're registered, you can go to the Secretary of State's website, and there is a link on my blog post. It's just always there. And you can check the Secretary of State and make sure that you haven't been purged because, you know, Republicans. Mm. Okay, getting on to the first story. From communityimpact.com, state local election officials target mail-in ballot rejections in CyFair. Ahead of the November 8th midterm election, state officials and Harris County election leaders are hoping to lower the rates of rejected mail-in ballots, which spiked compared to previous years during primary elections held in March and May. The increased rejection rates were seen in elections held 6 to 8 months after Senate Bill 1 added new voting requirements to Texas elections. Of course, that was the intent, but they won't say that. The number of mail-in ballots rejected in Harris County skyrocketed following the passage of SB 1 in September of 2021, jumping from 135 mail-in ballot rejections November of 2018 to 6,900 rejections in the March 1st primary, according to Harris County election administrators. Of course, that's not a bug, it's a feature, but I digress. Leah Shaw, the director of communications and voter outreach of the Harris County Election Administrator's Office, said the, quote, historic rate of mail-in ballot rejections was a big challenge for the county during the March and May primaries. She said there are new requirements under the law that require different information, including Texas ID or Social Security. We found that a lot of people who were filling the forms out, both for the application and the return ballot, were missing those required fields. And that created a kind of domino effect of rejections. I can say, as someone who does mail-in ballots, both my wife and I had problems with that. They're going to ask you for two. It's like your driver's license or your social. Just do both. Statewide, 24,636 mail-in ballots were rejected in the March one primary election, roughly 12.4% of all the mail-in ballots submitted, according to state data. According to a 2021 U.S. Election Assistance Commission report, Texas rejected roughly 8,300, or about 0.8% of nearly 1 million mail-in ballots cast in the 2020 presidential election. So, you know, bad. Although mail-in ballot rejections surged in March and the two elections held since then, the number of rejected mail-in ballots declined, according to state data. Well, sorry, Republicans. Sam Taylor, I'm being very snide. I've just been getting in that mood lately. Sam Taylor, Assistant Secretary of State for Communications, said he believes the decline in mail-in ballot rejection rates from March to May can be attributed to voters adjusting to the new voting changes. Obviously, Republicans will have to change them again. However, Taylor said the addition of reconciliation reports, which require counties to compare the number of voters who cast valid ballots with the number of votes counted by their tabulation system, has added a new layer of transparency. While the state and Harris County saw decreases in mail-in ballot rejections from March's primary election to the ones in May, Renee Cross, who is the senior director of the Hobby School of Public Affairs at U of H, said she believes the effect of SB 1 might not be completely visible until the November election. Not a bug, a feature. To be eligible to vote by mail in Texas, state law dictates an individual must be 65 or older, or sick or disabled, or out of the country during the election, or expected to give birth, or confined to jail but otherwise eligible to vote, which sounds confusing. It simply means that you've been jailed, but you haven't been convicted of anything. Under SB 1, voters are required to provide a partial social security number or driver's license number on their mail-in ballot. Best advice, do both in order to receive ballots. Once voters receive their ballots, they must then include the same numbers used on their applications for the ballots. Use both. Shah said even though the final number of mail-in ballot rejection rates was 19.2% for March, the percentage of ballots flagged for rejection before correction was close to 90%. This meant added time and labor for county workers to help voters correct their ballots, not to mention the people that didn't correct their ballots, I might add. While the privacy flap is required by law, the privacy flap being where you put those very, very important numbers for your ID, Taylor said after hearing feedback from counties that the ID portion of the ballot was being missed by voters, the state adjusted the ballot's design ahead of the November election. Changes include an added red outline to the ID portion of the ballot so it would be more noticeable. I'll let you know when I see mine. In preparation for November 8th, Leah Shaw, the director of communications, said Harris County officials have launched an educational campaign and community outreach program to educate voters. The county also added informational inserts to ballots to remind voters to fill out required fields and updated its voting resource site. And I have to ask you folks, what do you do with envelope inserts? Because mostly I think they just get tossed with 80% of the rest of the mail. Anyhow, to finish the story, Shaw noted Harris County also has a call center staffed with dozens of people who can answer voters' questions ahead of November. If you know me at all, you know I'll be talking about this further. Mm-hmm. Now, before the excerpts I just read, the article itself was longer. It was more detailed about confusion and obstacles voters may encounter. A lot of clarifying graphics are also included, so I strongly suggest when you go to thinkwingradio.com, do click on the link for this article and read the whole thing. Andrew? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the increase in rejections isn't really the question here, because the bill was designed to tighten verification, so more ballots are naturally going to be rejected. The question is, are these new verification measures fair, or are they designed to suppress the amount of people legitimately exercising their right to vote? Now, that may seem like a distinction without a difference, but if this were a courtroom, Republicans would give that exact defense about the bar being higher to clear in order to defend against if the number of rejections was brought up as the problem. Stories like these, or excerpts of them in our case, should focus more, in my opinion, on concrete cases of mail-in voters being unfairly rejected, because Republicans would have a lot harder time defending against that.
Hey, mine was rejected. My wife's was rejected. We both had to cure them. So, hey, I'm a personal story.
Ah, well, great. You should write about it.
Well, I blab about stuff like this all the time. So, you know, but some of it is actually in text that I post for the show. So
true,
but not this time. Okay. Next story from KHOU.com. Republican Harris County Commissioner Jack Cagle proposes a solution to budget and tax rate impasses. Cagle and Precinct 3 Commissioner Tom Ramsey, both Republicans, skipped the last two meetings, blocking a vote on the new budget and tax rate. Without them present, and we did talk about this in an earlier show, without them present, there weren't enough commissioners to legally move forward. Four of the five commissioners must be present to meet quorum. County Judge Lena Hidalgo said hiring freezes and fewer hospital services could happen soon. Last weekend, Hidalgo accused the two GOP members of playing politics and threatening funding to key departments. Cagle and Ramsey previously accused Hidalgo of using scare tactics, and, well, you know, they should know him when they see him, and telling the public false information about Harris County's hospitals and financial situation. Now, you know, when Republicans speak of doing stuff better and cheaper, which essentially is what Cagle is saying here, let's see what Franklin Roosevelt had to say about those sorts of promises.
Let me warn you, and let me warn the nation, against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things. We believe in Social Security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
Words to remember, words to live by. Andrew?
Well, as you often say, Mike, trying to do more with less eventually means trying to do everything with nothing. You know, I actually looked through, clicked through to the link of the article. Wow, that was hard to get out of my mouth. And that was a poorly worded. Anyway, I'm moving on. The article says that Cagle wants to discuss all the proposals on this topic before having to vote on them. And you know what? I can see that that's kind of fair. And Hidalgo is willing to do that as long as Cagle sends his proposal in so that the court can look it over before they all discuss it. Now, if Cagle wanted to move forward, he would do this, and he still has time to do so. But if he doesn't, he's just trying to create a political crisis that Republicans will try to pin on Democrats at election time.
Now, just to be fair, and I'm going to keep this very brief, it's not like trying to prevent a quorum in order to obstruct some kind of legislative action. It's not like that's unique to Republicans, and it's not unique to Democrats. It's something that minorities sometimes do when they don't have supermajorities, but they can't get a majority mustered. So I'm not going to indict Cagle and Ramsey for that. But, you know, basically they're saying less taxes, fewer services. And it's like, yeah, OK, that's why we don't want you guys. OK, the next story is from the Texas. Oh, yeah, we have time. The next story is from the Texas Tribune. Texas A&M's early voting location was popular during general elections before it was moved off campus. When Brazos County officials removed an early voting location off Texas A&M, a decision that spurred accusations of student voter suppression, at least one county commissioner cited poor voter turnout as a partial reason for the relocation. But data shows it was one of the county's most popular early voting sites in recent general elections. Commissioner Nancy Berry, who oversees the precinct that includes A&M, mentioned turnout at the Memorial Student Center as a supporting factor in moving the polling location to College Station City Hall for November's midterms, according to College Station's newspaper, The Eagle. And she similarly told the Houston Chronicle the location traditionally had a, quote, second to last in voter turnout of the five early voting locations, something that Christina Samuel, an A&M senior and president of voter engagement group Move Texas A&M, said she was told. According to Brazos County in-person voting data previewed by the Texas Tribune, the MSC had the county's second highest number of early voters in 2018 and 2020 general elections. The county's data shows that the MSC received 56,439 early voting ballots in 2018. The number fell during the pandemic in 2020 to 14,717, but this was in line with dips at all other polling locations in the county. When asked about these figures, Berry told the Tribune that what she meant by turnout was the amount of voters compared to the number of people who attend the school. She said the concentration of people on campus should have brought more early voters to the polling location. She said, when you think of 70,000 people that are right there, and then you have another 120,000 that are spread throughout the county, and that's not the highest voting site, even though you have that high a population of people, that was the point that it was a lower turnout number relative to the rest of the county. But Patrick Flavin, a political science professor at Baylor University, said the high number of people who cast ballots on campus in the previous general elections should justify using it again. Commissioner Berry had stated that she would be in favor of bringing the MSC polling station back for early voting next year. This kind of BS makes me so angry. You know, elections have consequences. There aren't do-overs in pretty much every case. And the stakes for 2023's elections will be much, much lower than this year's election. But I'm sure it was an honest mistake, invisible radio eye roll. It's often tiresomely said that this election is the most important in our history. And they've probably been saying that since at least 1964. And you know what? Cumulatively, they were right when they said it, because each conservative Republican president left a mark that has brought us to where we are now. Andrew?
Well, we had another voter suppression story earlier that I kind of criticized for the way that they took the approach they took to proving that something was going on. But this is exactly the right way to cover voter suppression stories, in my opinion. Hard facts that force backpedaling out of people who try to justify voter suppression, whether it's the result of poor decision making, like is being claimed here, or a conscious attempt at election meddling, which voter suppression is a form of. Now, of course, they should bring the campus polling station back. There's no good reason not to have polling stations on college campuses. Even if students don't use them, local residents will, because many campuses are centrally located.
Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1, Houston's community station. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on Show Posts and More at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. There is a search bar. It's just small, sort of upper right on the page. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. You can look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, plus Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Our next story is from the Texas Tribune. Governor Greg Abbott acknowledges New York City mayor's office did reach out about migrant busing efforts. Greg Abbott on Tuesday acknowledged New York City Mayor Eric Adams' office sent an email that was apparently a follow-up to a conversation seeking greater coordination of Texas's plans to bus migrants to the city, but the governor stressed that the mayor himself had not made direct contact. It was the latest in a back-and-forth between the two leaders, who have been publicly feuding over Abbott's efforts to bus thousands of migrants to cities run by Democratic mayors. Last month, Adams said in an interview at the Texas Tribune Festival that Abbott's office had rebuffed their efforts to coordinate the migrants' arrival and treatment and is merely using the migrants as political props without any intention of helping them. Abbott was again asked about whether he was rejecting efforts to coordinate with the cities on Friday during a debate with Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke. He again responded that Adams had not called his office. That comment prompted Adams' office to release on Twitter a redacted email dated August 1st, 4 days before the first bus of migrants reached New York City. That mayoral press secretary, Fabian Levy, said showed that someone from the mayor's office had reached out to someone from Abbott's office. On Tuesday, Abbott stressed that Adams himself had not reached out. Let me be clear about it, Abbott said. First, the question, as I recall in the debate, was, has the mayor ever talked to me about it or his administration? Abbott said Tuesday in Houston. Neither the mayor nor his administration has talked to me. From all the records that we have, from the time that we began the busing until today, there's been no level of contact whatsoever. There was an email that was found that was sent from the office of the mayor of New York City before the busing operation began, but I am unaware of any contact. But the point that I made most clearly was the mayor himself has done nothing to reach out. I want you to note, this is me now, I want you to note, this is Abbott trying to parse himself out of, if not a lie, then at least a half-truth. Sure, all politicians do that from time to time, but maybe we should give Abbott some credit. At least it's not an outright lie, although he did say some actual whoppers during the debate. Maybe we should talk about whose responsibility it is to call out lies of fact during a debate. Andrew?
Well, I don't think that we should give Abbott any credit at all. I think we should hammer every conspicuous silence, every half-truth, every outright lie until voters finally realize that this man is out for nobody but himself, and he only tells the truth when it benefits him. Sure, a lot of his voters are the same way, but I refuse to believe that most Texans are. If Abbott wanted the busing to be a legitimate option for new arrivals to the U.S., he'd have reached out to Eric Adams and the New York state government well before he announced the plan to make sure that the plan was handled as humanely and accessibly as possible. He didn't do that because he doesn't care one damn bit about those people. Now, as for the question of whose responsibility it is to call out lies of fact during a debate, well, if we're approaching it from the traditional debate rules, it's not really anyone's fault, or it's not really anyone's responsibility, because the point of a debate is not necessarily a formal one, at least, is not necessarily about genuine exchange of fact. It's you're judged based on how many people you convince in the room.
Well, I know. I mean, every once in a while, I run across stories about negotiations prior to debates, whether it's gubernatorial, presidential, or whatever, and I can't recollect clearly enough to make a claim, but I will say that there is usually at least one party, and I don't say this politically, one group that doesn't want any fact-checking.
Right.
And they don't want the moderator to be responsible or proactive in any fact-checking. As a matter of fact, I think in one of the presidential debates, I don't remember if it was the 2020 or the 2016, one of the moderators during one of the debates actually took it upon herself to do some fact-checking when someone told what she believed was either a lie or a half-truth. And later on, there were all kinds of complaints, and I think it was from the Republican side in this case, all kinds of complaints. There shouldn't be any kind of interference from the moderator and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? The simple truth is that whether it's a political campaign or a political debate, if your opponent starts making claims, even if the claims are bald-faced lies, if you start to direct your campaign to truth-checking those lies, responding to those lies, essentially your opponent has achieved one of their primary objectives, which is you're fact-checking instead of making your points in your election bid.
Right.
So it becomes a very, very tough thing. It's like when Biden and Trump were debating and Trump was saying some amazing whoppers, and like Biden had to make that choice in the moment. Do I want to start disputing what this liar is saying when he lies, or do I just want to make my points? And at some point, the volume of lies and half-truths becomes so great that the question becomes an impossible one.
Yeah.
Because so much out there that's being spewed is lying, and everything you say may be substantially true, and some of it may be parsed a little bit, but substantially true. But the lies are out there. And the example I used with Andrew when we were discussing this pre-show was when there was a debate in 2016 between Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's running mate. Tim Kaine, you know, presents as a little bit rumpled, hair not perfect, suit not perfectly pressed, whereas Mike Pence, he's a good-looking guy who was very well-groomed to the nines, hair, clothes, great posture. And Tim Kaine was basically saying facts. As far as I knew, I did not catch him in anything that I considered a lie or an untruth or a half-truth, at least to my knowledge. Whereas Mike Pence was just spewing misattribution after lie after exaggeration. But when people asked me who won the debate, I had to say Mike Pence did. Not because Mike Pence told the most truths or had the best platform, but because he looked the best in the course of his lying. His lying was actually much smoother than Tim Kaine's truth-telling.
Right.
This is the problem you confront.
Yeah, and that presentation was what allowed him to convince more minds and thus, literally, by standard debate metrics, win the debate.
So, you know, you can't force – there isn't legislation that actually forces candidates to debate.
Right.
That would actually be like another whole thing because you do have third parties, I'm sure Andrew is thinking. But
you just wait. You just wait until it's my turn to speak.
Yeah. But I think that there has to be an understanding that you cannot simply lie without a journalist who is typically a moderator questioning that.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be the exception. That should be the rule, because otherwise these debates are performances rather than informances, so to speak. Andrew?
Yeah,
I'll let you get the last words. Try to keep them short.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going with this. I mean, debates are perhaps, you know, official proper debates are perhaps not the best way of presenting multiple candidates, having and you know, comparing and contrasting their ideas and their arguments for and against. Because, as I've mentioned multiple times, the point of a debate is not to tell the truth. It is to convince people, regardless of what methods you use. And so if we had, you know, if we made changes to the debate system, which I think are long overdue, that would be one of the things that we should consider, you know, having a dedicated person in, whether that's the moderator or somebody else on stage or somebody in voiceover, whatever.
Kind of like the Jeopardy thing where the producers off stage are fact checking the answers.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody who is, it's their job to look things up and make sure that people are telling the truth and say, at least to the audience, if not the people on stage, when something is found to be false, or giving citations for when somebody says something true. I would also suggest that we, open the debates to more political parties, perhaps by lowering the polling thresholds, or, you know, widening the polling to, you know, national interest or whatever. But the problem with doing these things is that there is a government. Actually, I'm not even sure if it's a government body. It's the Commission on Presidential Debates for Presidential Debates.
Well, most of these rules are agreed by, but they're all voluntary.
Right. Most of these rules are agreed by the media and the candidates themselves. And so without, like, introducing some kind of new legislation to say debates are now the prerogative of, or at, now at least regulated by the FCC or the government of some form or fashion, there's nothing really that we can do to require any changes.
Maybe they need to put the debates under the Consumer Protection Bureau.
Hey,
because
yeah.
That's kind of, you know, what elections are. Consumers, and they need protection.
Yeah, I that's actually a legitimate. I think you may have to figure out how to present that argument in a more, shall we say, America revering way. But
maybe you need to nag me until I write a letter to Elizabeth Warren, because that's her baby.
Oh, okay.
The CPB is her baby.
Okay.
Okay. Next story from Politico.com. The Biden administration scales back student debt relief for millions amid legal concerns. The Biden administration is scaling back debt relief for millions of Americans over legal challenges from the student loan industry, as well as a new lawsuit from Republican-led states. In a reversal, the Education Department said on Thursday it would no longer allow borrowers who have federal student loans that are owned by private entities, in other words, they may have been resold, to qualify for the relief program. The administration had previously said those borrowers would have a path to receive up to $10,000 or $20,000 of loan forgiveness. The policy change comes as the Biden administration this week faces its first major legal challenges to the loan forgiveness program, which Republicans have railed against as an illegal use of executive power that is too costly for taxpayers. On Thursday, a group of six GOP attorneys, attorneys general rather, sued to block loan forgiveness. The states of Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and South Carolina asked for a federal judge to strike down the debt cancellation program, arguing that it's illegal and unconstitutional. The student loans that are guaranteed by the federal government but held by private entities account for a relatively small and shrinking subset of all outstanding federal student debt. They comprise just several million of the roughly 45 million Americans with federal student loans, but there are significant business interests that depend on the federally guaranteed loan program, a wide range of private lenders, banks, guarantee agencies, loan servicers, and investors. That industry is widely seen, both inside and outside the administration, as presenting the greatest legal risk to the debt relief program. So note, six GOP attorneys general sued to block loan forgiveness. That's because Republicans hate their citizens, except insofar as they can manipulate them and get their votes, at least as long as votes still matter. Amazingly, Texas is not on that list of states yet. Now, Andrew, I just want to make clear to people, this is Mike, because that may have sounded a lot like you.
Well, I do think that this story is a perfect example of why Democrats should get wild with policy. Because Republicans are going to fight whatever Democrats do, no matter what. So why hedge? If the student debt package had also made all college free, paid for by massive taxes on the rich, Republicans would be fighting that. Nobody would be paying attention to privately held federal student loans, or at least there would be enough of a distraction to get some of those loans forgiven. Politics is compromise, but compromising from a reasonable position nets nothing. You start by asking for way more than you need, and you agree down to what you really want.
Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community media. We now air on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and re-air on Thursdays at 6 p.m. At Think Wing Radio, we scour the news for stuff you may not know or you may not have seen. We need your support to be able to keep doing that. So please donate to KPFT. Call 713-526-5738. That's 713 526-5738, or go online to kpft.org and make your pledge of support in order to keep commercial-free community radio on the air. Now, each time you turn the radio to KPFT, you can hear your dollars at work. When you donate to KPFT, your dollars are paying for transmitter and equipment costs, the airtime for progressive shows like Think Wing Radio, Politics Done Right, and other locally generated political talk shows, for KPFT's online streaming, maintaining a wide variety of music programs, paying for the very, very few paid employees that we do have at the station. So KPFT really depends on your financial support to keep bringing you Think Wing Radio and our other programming. Contribute whatever you can. And please, when you do, pick the show you're supporting. It would be great if it was Think Wing Radio, but please pick a show if you can. No amount is too large or too small, and it's all tax deductible. $5 a month, $10 one time, $15 a month. It may not, depending on your particular circumstances, $5, $10, $15 a month may not feel like a lot each month. But for the station, it adds up and it gives us a predictable source of income. It's really very helpful. And of course, depending on your pledge, you may qualify for a nice thank you gift. And when you make your contribution, you'll be able to choose from among many, depending on what your contribution is. Okay, our next story is from the Washington Post. CPAC backpedals on pro-Russia tweet as some U.S. conservatives back Putin. The prominent conservative group decided gift-giving to Ukraine while adopting Putin's view of Ukraine-occupied territories. Or rather, decried gift-giving, I should say. I don't think I said that the first time. Prominent Republicans are digging in against American support for Ukraine despite Russia's threats to use nuclear weapons and evidence of mass graves and war crimes facilitated by Moscow. The Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, on Friday tweeted, and then hours later deleted, a message that called on Democrats to, quote, end the gift-giving to Ukraine, while featuring a fluttering Russian flag. The tweet also referred to Ukraine-occupied territories, appearing to legitimize Russian President Vladimir Putin's claims to annex provinces based on a referendum, series of referendums or referenda on Saturday that the U.S. and allies view as illegal. CPAC Chairman Matt Schlapp on Saturday said the tweet did not clear the normal approval process because he was traveling for a conference in Austria, he texted. In a statement, CPAC itself expressed support for Ukraine, but maintained opposition to American aid for the embattled country. The statement said, "We must oppose Putin, but American taxpayers should not be shouldering the vast majority of the cost." CPAC has repeatedly flirted with pro-Putin views in recent years, including hosting Hungary's pro-Russia Prime Minister Viktor Orban at a Dallas conference in August. CPAC is not alone among American conservatives in opposing Ukrainian aid despite Putin's invasion. Fox News host Tucker Carlson has alleged U.S. sabotage. Now, this is cute. Carlson has alleged U.S. sabotage for leaks in the Russian gas pipeline in Europe, baseless claims that have earned him airtime on Russian state television. Former President Donald Trump also posted a message on his Truth Social platform offering himself as a negotiator for the conflict. At a Trump rally in Michigan on Saturday, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, reiterated her opposition to USA to Ukraine and said Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should negotiate a peace settlement with Russia. She said, "We have so many problems here at home. I cannot even think about sending our money over to fund a proxy war with Russia," she said in an interview. "Zelensky doesn't run the United States government. He is not our president." Apparently Biden isn't either, according to her lights, but nevertheless, he is not our president. But for some reason, Joe Biden bends over every single time. The American people don't care about that war over there. OK, now the first thing I'll say is on last week's show, we half jokingly speculated that it was really hard to tell who actually blew holes in those Nord Stream pipelines, because it's like if you're going to send a message, this was a very vague message. And, you know, we said, well, it could be Russia. They have the resources. The United States, you know, maybe they want to accelerate European divestment
Russia,
thank you,
Russian gas.
Of Russian petroleum products. It could be the Ukrainians, you know, because that way it makes their allies less dependent on Russia. I mean, there are a number of actors, including large capitalistic cartels that might want to grab that business for themselves. But the thing is, we were doing that as an exercise in wild speculation, because literally otherwise no one knew anything. Even now, only a few facts have come out.
And we did not claim that we had evidence that that was going on or that that was something that was certain. We merely, wasn't necessarily jokingly suggesting it. I was saying it was a possibility, but I wasn't saying it was likely because nothing's likely because all we know right now is the thing's blown up.
Actually, I ran across a joke on Twitter during the week that someone from the European Union said, and I forget the exact number, but stay with me, something like 400 kilograms of explosive were used to blow holes in the pipeline.
Yes,
and
I remember that.
That made someone conclude, well, it couldn't have been the U.S. then because we use pounds.
Yes, I think I sent that to you, actually.
Yeah, I think maybe you did. Yeah, that was pretty good. Anyway, so Andrew and I also discussed last week what a quisling was. A quisling is a noun taken from a proper name. It comes from a Norwegian military. I'm not going to read the whole thing we did last week, but it comes from a Norwegian military officer and Nazi collaborator who nominally headed the government of Norway during the country's occupation by Nazi Germany during World War II. What Republicans have demonstrated this week, this is IMHO, if you hadn't noticed previously, is that many of them are quislings and quislings in waiting. They literally cheered a victory by an Italian party that literally is descended from Mussolini's fascists. This is because, whether they realize it or not, they are wannabe fascists. And whether they know it or not doesn't really matter. Many folks are confused by why the previously vociferous anti-Soviet Republicans have become so pro-Putin cheerleaders and water carriers. I kind of reached a conclusion on this years ago and discussed it on this very show. I haven't read this anywhere else before since, probably because it would be a very contentious thing to say. Someone may have said it. But so many Republicans are now pro-Putin, Italy's pro-neo-fascist Meloni, France's pro-fascist Marine Le Pen, Hungary's pro-fascist Orban, etc., in my opinion, is because the Soviets were officially promoting atheism. Putin, Meloni, Le Pen, Orban, and other ultra-right-wingers in Europe and the United States, for that matter, are basically Christian nationalists, as are many of the Republicans in this country. I actually have a sneaking suspicion that if China's Xi Jinping were suddenly advocating Christianity, they would probably overnight become pro-Xi. I agree with very little of what might be called even moderate Republican conservatism. But these Republicans are not conservatives. Today's Republicans are reactionary extremists. They are vipers at the chest of constitutional America. January 6th was the vipers' taste test. If we don't vote these people out of our government over the next 2 years, we may literally not have another chance to have a meaningful election. Those of you who have followed me for a while know I'm not typically prone to hyperbole. That's because this is not hyperbole. Andrew?
Well, some people might be tempted to draw parallels between conservative support for Putin and the left's advocacy for peace talks and moderation in the U.S. military response to the invasion of Ukraine. I don't see them as equatable at all. U.S. conservatives are backing Putin because he is also a conservative. He is a capitalist, and as Mike said, Christian nationalist, and his ruling party has turned Russia into a capitalist Christian nationalist state. It's a
you left out oligarchic.
Well, yes, that's true. Capitalist.
Sorry to throw you off.
Yeah, that's all right. Capitalist, oligarchic, Christian nationalist state. It's a political play for U.S. conservatives. If they support Russia now, they can have one less opponent on the world stage when they try to turn the U.S. into the same kind of state. And I think that that is also one of the reasons why, even if Xi Jinping suddenly became a Christian nationalist overnight, I still don't think they may not support him after that, because they still like to have an international boogeyman. Russia's not that anymore because Putin is moving in the direction that they like, but China has taken the place of that, I think. Left-wing peace advocacy and criticism of U.S. involvement in the invasion of Ukraine is intended to bring about the fairest resolution possible as quickly as possible, thereby saving the most amount of lives possible, and, importantly, doesn't try to justify Russia's invasion of uncontested Ukrainian territory. As with many cases, the difference here between left and right is the left is trying to save lives, while the right is trying to control them.
I'm just going to add one thing as sort of an aside. You know, I make movie and TV allusions from time to time.
Yep.
There used to be a really interesting political satire show called That Was the Week That Was, or what it was sometimes called was TW3. It was like 1963-ish, maybe. And they once did a sketch where they did a number of sketches where they talked about World War III, because, you know, that's hilarious. And And one of them, and I don't remember precisely how it went, but the general idea was they were doing a faux report on the war, and they were talking about how the, and now mind you, this is only about 19 years after the end of World War II. Mm-hmm. It's like closer in time than 9/11 is to us.
Wow.
So yeah. Just to put that in perspective, living memory, right? And the faux report went something like, the United States and its allies, Germany and Japan, fought against their enemies, Russia, the Soviet Union, France and Turkey, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
Because, you know, alliances change in weird ways over time.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. Xi Jinping suddenly becoming a darling of the Republican Party because he might, in an alternate universe, become a Christian nationalist. You know, weirder things in history have happened.
I kind of feel like in order for that to happen, Putin would have to be suddenly deposed or something, and then Russia would have to be reversing its aims here, or its path. I don't know, but yeah, stranger things, you know.
Let me make one speculative speculation as to a potential outcome of the current war between Russia and Ukraine.
Okay.
And I mean, there's a lot of variables that go into this, so it's not a prediction per se. It's just a possible outcome is if the Ukrainians, with the use of Western training, Western weaponry, Western strategy and tactics, and their own, which appear to be also really creative, let's say they actually manage a crushing defeat of the Russian military.
Okay.
Now, let's remember the last time there was a crushing defeat of the Russian military in a war. Do you recall when that was?
Not off the top of my head, no.
1917.
Oh!
When Germany defeated Russia and had a peace treaty with them, and there was a lot of unrest, and eventually it became the Communist Revolution.
And
it wasn't just the – there were several revolutions of which the Communist Bolshevik Revolution just became the last and most successful.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that there will be that kind of a revolution in Russia if the Russian military is devastated, just like if there's a civil war in the United States. It's not going to be like the last one with standing armies of opposing countries. But I could see a scenario where with a severely weakened Russia covering 11 time zones, you know, China has claims on eastern Siberia, and Japan has claims on islands that used to be Japanese that the Soviets occupied at the end of the war and didn't want to give back and still don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody, every country, if you go back in history far enough and sometimes not so far, has a grievance against some other country. And if Russia's military is sufficiently devastated, they lose a lot of men, they lose a lot of materiel, equipment, ammunition, their politics goes into disarray, Putin dies or is overthrown or is assassinated. And all of a sudden, you have a lot of new power centers. And if you think that the devolution of the Soviet Union into a number of independent states like Ukraine and Belarus and Kazakhstan and a number of others, Armenia and Azerbaijan, et cetera, if you think that was a big fragmentation, imagine not only the internal, like the Chechens, just as one group, you have groups around Russia that don't like being ruled from Moscow. And you might end up with, let's say, China or even the United States or who knows how many enemies Russia has once the blood is in the water to aid or assist or abet some of these separatist movements. I mean, this could be like one of the biggest pivotal moments that we're on the cusp of literally in human history. It will be the equivalent. But, well, I mean, the collapse of the Soviet Union was already like the equivalent of the fall of the Roman Empire. But, you know, this we're talking about living through something again in my lifetime. This would be the second time. Now, I'm not predicting that this will happen, but I think it's a legitimate scenario to think about.
Oh, I mean, yeah, anything can happen at this point. I mean,
things are static in the world until they're not.
Yeah. Exactly. And things go not static very, very quickly. So.
Okay. I think what we're going to have is one last story.
Well, we should probably take our last break first.
Did I not? Oh, shoot. Oh, shoot. I just got distracted by all the interesting conversation. Okay. Well, instead of that, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. It'll usually be a re-airing, but you never know. You can also hear the show online at kpft.org. You can podcast it, which I recommend, or you can visit archive.kpft.org that not only has older shows of Think Wing Radio, but also we have like 100 other titles that broadcast on HD1, HD2, FM. I mean, we have like 100 other shows. Now, we at Think Wing Radio heavily excerpt every story on the show, which is why we include links to full articles at thinkwingradio.com. I may be the only radio show host that literally puts essentially my entire script, everything I'm reading, with links on the blog. So you can literally check what I say, why I say it, and where I get it from. So you can just go to thinkwingradio.com, click on show posts and more at the top of the thinkwingradio.com page. Find the post for the show or show date you're looking for, or type words into the key bar. We're also on social media, where we take questions, comments, and suggestions. And you can check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. You can also look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. See, I forgot the name of my show. I'm getting close to my 72nd birthday, and you know they say memory is the second thing to go. Okay. Anyhow, and Andrew has his stuff.
I do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, our last story is actually based – the story I chose is actually an opinion piece by Paul Krugman of the New York Times. Could have been any one of a number of other pieces, but the point is the same. The article I'm going to read is a little short, but actually I hope you'll find it an interesting history lesson. The piece is called How Liz Truss Did So Much Damage in So Few Days. Liz Truss became Britain's prime minister less than a month ago and may have set a political speed record. She certainly isn't the first leader who has been forced to make a policy U-turn in the face of adverse market reactions. But announcing an economic program and then abandoning its central plank just 10 days later is something special. And those of us on the center left can, I think, be forgiven for feeling a bit of schadenfreude. Conservatives constantly warn progressive policies will be punished by the bond vigilantes, who they claim will drive up interest rates at the prospect of any increase in public spending. Such warnings usually are proved wrong. In Britain, however, the bond vigilantes actually did make an appearance, kind of like no one expects the Spanish Inquisition, I guess. Interest rates shot up after the Truss government announced its economic plans, but the market wasn't reacting to excessive spending. It was reacting to irresponsible tax cuts. How big a tax cut did Truss propose? She and her officials announced their policy without a budget score, which contributed to the market's loss of confidence. And the particular tax cut that was just abandoned was a reduction in the top rate and was only part of the total. So why was the market reaction so fierce? Partly because Truss and Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, justified their moves with the much discredited claim that reducing top rates would provide a huge boost to economic growth. There was also a claim in a different article that the tax cuts would eventually pay for themselves. More on that later. This raised doubts about their competence and indeed their connection to reality. Now, this is where old guy living memory starts to take apart. I recollect that claim was made that the proposed tax cut would eventually pay for itself in 5 years. And the point is that there is actually a name for the economic policy that Truss and Kwarteng proposed. It's not mentioned in any of the articles I read, but I'll name it. It's called Reaganomics. There's also a name for the economic theory that they based their assumptions on, although they may not have done this intentionally. It's called the Laffer Curve. No, really, that's what it's called. It was even funny at the time, not just because the theory was so crazy. It was actually an idea put forward by an economist by the name of Arthur Laffer. But I digress momentarily. These theories have been tried out in the real world in the U.S. They resoundingly did not work. So, of course, a new generation of conservatives are determined to try them again. Now, in Wikipedia, Reaganomics is partly described as the pillars of Reagan's economic policy included increasing defense spending, balancing the federal budget, slowing the growth of government spending, reducing the federal income tax and capital gains tax, reducing government regulation, and tightening the money supply in order to reduce inflation. The results of Reaganomics are still debated. Supporters point to the end of stagflation. The Jimmy Carter period had to suffer that because of the oil embargoes. They also cite stronger GDP growth and an entrepreneurial revolution in the decades that followed. Critics point to the widening income gap, what they described as an atmosphere of greed, reduced economic mobility, and the national debt tripling in 8 years, which ultimately reversed the post-World War II trend of a shrinking national debt as a percentage of GDP. In his 1980 campaign speeches, Reagan presented his economic proposals as a return to the free enterprise principles, free market economy that had been in favor before the Great Depression. Now, as soon as you say that, you have to wonder, right? The policies just before the Great Depression were working apparently great. But I digress. At the same time, Reagan attracted a following from the supply-side economics movement, which formed in opposition to Keynesian demand stimulus economics, which appear to work better. This movement produced some of the strongest supporters for Reagan's policies during his term in office. The contention of the proponents that the tax rate cuts would more than cover any increases in federal debt was influenced by a theoretical taxation model based on the elasticity of tax rates known as the Laffer curve. That's L-A-F-F-E-R. Good pun, though. The Laffer curve, according to Wikipedia, in economics, named after Arthur Laffer, an economist, illustrates a theoretical relationship between rates of taxation and the resulting levels of the government's tax revenue. One implication of the Laffer curve is that increasing tax rates beyond a certain point is counterproductive for raising further tax revenue. In the United States, conservatives have used the Laffer curve to argue that lower tax rates may actually increase tax revenue. A 2012 poll of leading economists found none agreed. 71% disagreed. 31% were either uncertain or had no opinion or didn't bother answering the questionnaire that reducing U.S. federal income tax rates would result in higher annual tax revenues within 5 years. So basically, Liz Truss's government sort of cribbed Reaganomics. So this is more evidence that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And it rhymes stronger when people are ignorant of history or are actively in denial of the cause and effect that's been proven by history. Andrew?
Well, by far the best part of this whole news story for me is the most recent election polling in the UK. Politico's poll of polls says that as of October 2nd, 48% of respondents were considering voting Labour, and just 26 were considering voting Conservative, 26%, I should say, not 26 people. Some people are predicting that if an election were held now, the Conservatives would lose all but a handful of seats in Parliament. And excitingly for me, the Greens would pick up a second seat. Now, I don't expect that to take effect anytime soon, as legislation back in March gave the power to call elections exclusively back to the Prime Minister, and if Liz Truss doesn't do that, it'll be another 2 years and 2 months before the next mandatory parliamentary election. But hopefully, this is a sign of how the rest of Truss's term will play out: boneheaded moves and impending Conservative losses.
Well, you know, the I'm not going to say the technical definition. Let's say the pop definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Mm-hmm.
I think that tends to describe conservatives a lot more than liberals.
Absolutely.
Because
I absolutely say so.
I think liberals, which for me is mostly the Democratic Party, mostly, I think liberals are more performance oriented. If they do a policy and it doesn't work well, they don't necessarily double down on it. They try to modify it. Maybe they'll abandon it. Maybe they'll do something else. Republicans, they have this thing that they like to take pride in: Republican philosophy, conservative philosophy, conservative economics. And every time they're in power, and I think you can trust me and look back on this and find that I'm correct. Every time Republicans are in power, they try to run government according to conservative principles, not based on actual policy performance. They'll scrap all the liberal policies that might be working because, you know, either they don't like them philosophically or they don't like them fiscally, or they want to do everything with nothing, do more with less.
Or they don't like them because they didn't put them in place.
There's that. I think there's a certain amount of human ego that comes into place. But the point with Republican conservatives is they keep doing the same things over and over again, convinced that this time, surely, it will work.
Mm.
At least that's been my observation over the last six decades I've been paying attention.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, liberals and leftists as well, the left generally, is more willing to actually look at the real world results of their policies and modify those policies or drop them if necessary, depending on how well they've actually performed and whether they're actually improving people's lives or not. I think Republicans are very, and conservatives again generally, are much more enamored with this idea of running government like a business. They think they've cracked exactly how a successful organization of any type, of any size, is run under capitalism. And that's basically for the benefit of everybody.
You got me started. All right. As soon as you start talking about conservatives wanting to run government like a business, then I start talking about the socioeconomic tripod that actually is the basis of successful governing. It's just like the nuclear triad has airborne nuclear, land-based nuclear, and submarine nuclear. And to me, a successful socioeconomic triad is business, labor, government. Those are not the same things. They all have different interests, although occasionally they may have some overlapping interests. When you have one leg, or in some cases two, that become too weak, then what you have is an imbalance in civil government, in government planning. So like right now, labor is very weak. There are some signs it's coming back. But when labor got extremely weak, that made business basically move into that power vacuum, which got us to where we are today. Now, going back just for a moment to the Reaganomics with the tax cuts, you know, during Eisenhower's era, the highest incomes had the highest rates at 90%. Now, that's not 90% of every dollar. That's 90% of income above a certain dollar point.
Right, which is very important to hammer home because a lot of people assume it was 90% of every dollar. It was not.
Yeah, people just don't get the idea of tax rates, you know, sort of nominal tax rates.
Yeah.
But since Reagan, essentially Democrats and other liberals have been really struggling to try to get more progressivity back into the tax system. It's proving very, very challenging, partly because Republicans, and they've been in too much power too long and too inflexibly, and also because you still have Democrats that have grown up in a time when, 35% was a lot.
Yeah.
And boy, when you've got $500 million, 35% is not a lot.
And a lot of them grew up in that Reaganomics era where that was the political wisdom. That was what was necessary in order to profess your belief in order to get successful when running for a campaign. And so they still think in those terms. And I will say on the subject of the socio-political triad, as I always say when you bring that up, you're right, but it's necessary. It's what maintains a capitalist liberal democracy. It's not a universal thing, but it is necessary to keep the United States going. So, you know, depending
on your feelings on that. Well, if you didn't have business and if you didn't have labor, because communist countries don't like labor unions either. So they don't have business influence. They don't have labor influence. So that means you're on a pogo stick.
They don't like labor. That's an interpretation.
Well, they don't like labor the same way Republicans don't like their citizens.
I disagree with that. That's an interpretation. That's
okay.
We
are so far over time.
Going
to be so annoyed when he starts working on this. So I get annoyed before we do a show, and he just gets annoyed after. So there is symmetry in the universe. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, and occasionally irritated compatriot is Andrew Ferguson. And we hope you found the show interesting, informative, enjoyable, and we'll hopefully talk to you again tomorrow and hopefully talk to you again twice next week. Take care.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and
make the connection between your favorite programs on KPFT and your power to keep them on the air. As a nonprofit organization, we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We count on listeners like you for donations, programming, and much of our staffing. That's how KPFT and Pacifica Radio work. Without listener support, 90.1 would be radio silence. Your contribution keeps the lights on, powers our transmitters, and covers our bandwidth. Becoming a member is quick, easy, tax-deductible, and secure. Just call or text GIVE to 713-526-5738 or go online to kpft.org. Become a member today and join the special group of heroes who keep KPFT on the air and free for everyone. You have the power. Connect to 526-5738 or go to kpft.org today.
Last time you went to see a local band play a concert, how much did you spend on the ticket? Did you maybe go out to dinner beforehand? Pay for parking? Maybe have coffee afterwards? The costs add up. I love going to concerts, but it's one of those things you can't do daily, yet KPFT lets you hear the great performers and local artists from Houston and all over the world every single day. KPFT is a rather unusual operation. We don't charge for the concert tickets. We simply trust that you'll support the great service you listen to every day. Contribute the amount that feels right to you in support of 90.1 KPFT. And please consider becoming a sustaining member. Make your contribution to this station right now. Just call 713-526-5738 or give online at KPFT.org.